weather and climate often cause concern and curiosity, but understanding the facts behind the phenomena can be a challenge. We're here to help. From the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and Illinois Public Media, welcome to Weather Realness, a weekly podcast about the skies above Illinois and the world. I'm your host, Maddie Stover, a doctoral student in physics here at the U of I.
And I'm Trent Ford, state climatologist at the Prairie Research Institute, and today we're talking about solar energy.
In last week's episode, we talked about how increased carbon emissions into the atmosphere are driving more severe weather events like extreme heat and flooding. Therefore, reducing carbon emissions is a necessary step in transitioning to a more sustainable future.
And there are many tools available to help us reduce carbon emissions, one of which is renewable energy. Renewable energy is energy from a source that's not depleted when it's used, like wind or solar. Most forms of renewable energy also do not directly emit carbon into the atmosphere. Today, we're going to dive into solar energy, one of these carbon-free types of renewable energy that can help us pave the way to a greener future.
To talk about solar energy, we are joined by Madhu Khanna, Director of the Institute for Sustainability, Energy, and Environment at the U of I, and she is a professor in agriculture and consumer economics, also at the U of I. We're joined also by Larry Lee, Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering at the U of I, and Director of the Heloniak Micro and Nanotechnology Lab at the U of I. Welcome, Madhu and Larry. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having us here.
So Madhu, what do you do as Director of the Institute for Sustainability, Energy, and the Environment?
One of the missions of the Institute is to bring faculty and researchers from across campus to work together on complex sustainability challenges. And increasing our supply of renewable energy, most of which is land-based, such as utility-scale solar, really does require bringing together engineers, crop scientists, biologists, and economists to look at what is the best way to use our land to produce food and energy.
And Larry, could you tell us about your work on solar energy engineering as faculty in electrical and computer engineering?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. My research is mostly focused on the materials and the device physics that are involved with solar cells and how to improve their efficiency and their reliability. And that's all part of a larger role, which is research on semiconductors here at the University of Illinois. And so as it turns out, the same semiconductor silicon, which is used to make microchips and memory chips and GPUs and all those other things we hear a lot about, it's the same material that's used to make solar cells as well.
And Madhu, you know, kind of starting very basically, or what is solar energy and what are some of the benefits of solar energy?
So solar energy is basically harvesting the sun's energy in order to convert it into electricity that we can then use like any other electricity from the grid, except that this is zero emissions energy. And so it is not releasing carbon emissions into the atmosphere. And that is why it's a great way to be able to continue to use energy without having to worry about worsening climate change.
And Larry, on the engineering side, could you kind of talk us through how solar panels work?
One thing that's important, it gets pretty nuanced, is an important thing about solar panels is that they don't take in any fuel or emit any carbon while they're being operated. However, it does take carbon to manufacture them in the first place. The good news is that there's been a lot of analysis over the years in terms of how long does it take. They, in fact, have a term for it, carbon payback time. How long does it take for solar panels to essentially reduce carbon beyond what was used in manufacturing them? And it depends on a lot of things. And the National Renewable Energy Lab in Golden, Colorado, recently released a report, and they said they declared the middle of Kansas to be a benchmark location for Americans to consider. And they said in that part of the country, it only takes 2 years before an installed solar panel starts to have a net negative carbon impact. So I just want to emphasize, though, that it does take carbon to manufacture them. So just briefly on the side of the physics of what happens, basically a solar cell, it's a semiconductor, which is, like I said before, the same stuff that's used to make chips. And what it's doing here is it's directly taking the energy that's in sunlight and it's converting a fraction of that directly into DC electrical power that we can use. And it takes advantage of certain properties of semiconductors that allow them to essentially asymmetrically flow a current. So in other words, there's only one correct way that you can wire up a solar panel. You know, you can do it forwards or you can do it backwards. Whereas a normal conductor like metal, it doesn't have like a positive end and a negative end. Whereas a solar panel, it has to have this property very broadly we call polarity. It has to have a high potential side and a low potential side. And that asymmetry that's in there, that's created in semiconductors using processes that are very related to how we make microchips. But the scale is completely different. Whereas microchips, we want the features to be smaller and smaller and smaller. In silicon solar panels, we want to manufacture them with very, very large area, very quickly and very efficiently. So the scientific basis and foundation is the same, but the way they get implemented is very different.
And could you talk a little bit, you alluded to this before, as in talking about how it takes carbon to, our carbon emissions to make a solar panel. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about more about the life cycle of a solar cell?
Yeah, I will just try to talk about the case of silicon solar cells because they're by far the most common, both in the United States and in general in the world. So essentially, we have to start by getting silica, silicon dioxide, sand, or in its mineral form. And we have to reduce that. So we have to turn it from silicon dioxide into essentially what we call metallurgical grade silicon. And we have to put in quite a bit of heat in order to basically get the carbon to react with the oxygen that's in SiO2. And in fact, one of the byproducts should be carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide from that process. So not only is it electricity intensive, but the reaction byproduct should be a carbon-containing greenhouse gas. After that, we have to further purify the silicon, and we liquefy it. We use various chemical processes to turn it into a liquid form, which we can essentially distill. And having removed most of the impurities from that silicon, then we have to melt it all back down again, and we have to turn it into very large crystals of silicon. And again, those are energy-intensive processes. Everything is glowing red hot when we're doing that. So you know that there is a good amount of energy that's being input into making that. And those are the most carbon-intensive parts of the job. Once the silicon solar panels are made, the silicon solar cells are made, they have to be put into a panel, and that involves some, you know, glass covers, some Mylar sheets, and an aluminum frame. So all of those have some emission of carbon, but they're really based on pretty low-cost manufacturing techniques that maybe aren't that different from like construction products on a house, like windows and stuff like that, once the silicon part is done.
And once they're made, how long do they last for, solar panels?
Yeah, so this is a really great part about solar technology, and also one of the big challenges for new technologies as well. They actually come with typically a 30-year warranty on them. And they degrade at only about 0.5% to 1%. Relative per year. That doesn't mean they're losing one efficiency percent. They're losing 1% of their performance per year. So that at the end of their lifetime, they're still delivering about 88% to 90% of the performance that they were originally specified with. So that is fantastic news. And it also creates a real challenge for people who want to innovate, because not only does it have to be mass producible in order to make a big impact in terms of energy generation, it also has to be made using molecules and compounds and crystals that don't degrade, even with 30 years, you know, in the sunlight, you know, in the heat and the snow and the hail and things like that.
So, Larry, could you talk about how you store solar energy when the sun is not shining?
Yeah, energy storage is one of the biggest challenges for solar because, of course, it's an intermittent power source, meaning that it only generates while the sun is directly shining on it. So anything from a very brief interruption from a cloud to, of course, sunset makes the power generation diminish and then go away. So this has been a major area of development, I think, in the field over the past few years. The majority of the storage that's done is with lithium-ion batteries. And those are very similar technology to what is in electric vehicles and what's in electronic gadgets. And I guess even without a major recent technological revolution, we've incrementally gotten continuous improvements in that technology, and particularly the cost has come down a lot as well. There are some other ways to store solar energy. One of them is to try to store it directly as heat, and that has some challenges with it and some really nice things about it as well. It's not lithium intensive, for example, and hopefully we'll be hearing a lot more about how we can intelligently use heat to store some solar energy. But right now, I think, you know, whether it's a home power wall type of product or a utility scale version of something like that, it's basically lithium ion batteries.
You're listening to Weather Realness, the podcast about Illinois weather and climate. I'm Maddie Stover, PhD physics student at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, along with Illinois State climatologist Trent Ford. We're talking about solar energy with Larry Lee, professor of electrical and computer engineering at the U of I, and Madhu Khanna, director of the Institute for Sustainability, Energy, and Environment, also at the U of I.
Speaking of storing solar energy outside of lithium ion, I have a neighbor who has a quote unquote for their hot tub, and the way they heat it is they run the hose along stretches of their roof. And so during the summer, it heats anyway. Apropos to nothing, but yeah, innovative nonetheless of using solar power.
Oh, no, that's very apropos. And that's where actually the engineering part is so valuable. You know, solar hot water is a really, really nice way to get some more energy out of sunlight. And however, it is not, you know, because of thermodynamics, it's not enough to generate a lot of electricity off of, because we can't run a, you know, Maddie, you're a physics PhD candidate, so you know about Carnot limits and things like that. So we just can't make much electricity off of it. But in terms of making hot water for, you know, industrial and homes, it's a nice way to get some useful energy out, but we can't get much electricity out of that warm water. Yeah.
Okay. And so, Maddie, I'm pulling you in here. How much, generally speaking, how much solar energy do we use here in Illinois?
I think our total renewable energy is something like 16-20%.
And is that something that is, do we have capacity for growing that over, you know, the next several
years? No, there's significant capacity to grow our supply of solar energy, not only in Illinois, but across the country. And you know, among the different ways in which we can produce solar energy, the fastest growing way is utility scale solar, which is ground mounted solar. And it is estimated that even to meet our needs by 2050, we actually need only 1 to less than 2% of our cropland to produce that energy. So cropland, it turns out, is actually one of the best ways to produce utility-scale solar energy because it's flat, it's got unobstructed access to the sun, and it's well-drained and connected to the grid. And so there is increasing, about 93% of the solar energy that we're currently producing as utility-scale is really placed in rural areas. And about, I think, at least two-thirds or 70% of that land was previously under crop production. So that is one of the challenges that we face, that increasingly the placement of this method of producing energy is going to be competing with other uses of cropland.
Yeah. And, you know, this being a weather climate focused show, bringing this back to the kind of climate system and climate change, excuse me, how important is solar energy to climate smart energy system kind of globally?
So we know that in order to get to net zero by, the end of the century, which is what we need to do in order to keep temperatures less than 2 degrees centigrade, we're going to have to curtail the amount of fossil fuels that we're using. And yet we want to continue to be able to access energy services. In order to do that, we have to increase our use of renewables like solar and wind. And we also at the same time have to look at ways in which we can draw down carbon from the atmosphere through other mechanisms. And that include using the land as a sink for carbon through climate smart practices. So solar energy has significant potential to grow. It's, although it is land intensive, but the total amount and the aggregate, the amount of land that's needed is relatively small compared to other ways in which we can displace fossil fuels, including bioenergy. And the cost of solar has been coming down as well. So with increasing availability of storage systems, this has the potential to be a substantial mechanism for us to produce clean energy in the future.
And just a quick follow-up while we have Larry here. On the engineering side, Madhu, you alluded to the grid. Is the grid kind of set up, as it's set up now, is it conducive to using solar energy at a large scale?
It's not perfectly set up to use particularly intermittent sources of electricity. In some ways, I think the grid can be happy with... The grid needs a mix of both things that can cycle up and cycle down and other things that provide steady energy production. So like nuclear is a great example where, 24/7, no matter what the weather is, it can produce a very, very steady amount of output. However, California has been a really great case study of this because they probably lead the nation in terms of total renewable production and solar production. And so in terms of their electricity, during the daytime is when solar is generating at its peak. And they have there's this famous thing they call the duck curve, where basically as the sun sets and people go home and turn on their air conditioners, there's a sudden surge of demand that's needed. And so that learning about that maybe 10 years ago time frame, it forced me to realize that storing solar energy, we don't really need to store. I mean, it would be great to be able to store for a day or for even weeks or months or seasons worth of electricity to account for lower generation during the winter. But the nearest term thing is just those few hours where the duck, anyway, it's this curve that goes down and you can be overproducing during the daytime and you will underproduce, of course, in the evening and not able to meet demand. So that's, again, where storage can really help to smooth that out, not just for homeowners, but also for grid operators as well. There's some really interesting stats that have come out where it's certain like times of day and certain times of year, more than 50% of California's energy, electricity, I should say, is getting generated renewably or by solar. And I heard that, I think there's some global stat that the United States is at 17% electricity is from solar right now, which is, it's really incredible compared to where it was when I first started my research on solar cells. It was well under 1%. Yeah. So it's grown a lot, and further growth requires more and more storage, I would say.
So 30 years on a panel. And then of course, if you get the lithium ion battery, that may or may not have a similar shorter lifespan. How does disposal or recycling of these panels work? I mean, presumably with all this buildup or growth, maybe if we look down the road 15, 20 years from now, we're going to probably be dealing with a lifetime, right? So how do we deal with that to not make a disposal problem?
Yeah, that's a great question. What I've gathered is that most of the materials can be recovered. So, most of it, I'd like to say, think of it like trying to recycle some building materials maybe. So if most of the panels made out of glass and aluminum, I think we have relatively mature ways to get back a lot of those materials. The silicon itself is a question. I mean, it was previously a highly purified material, but by the time it's been processed into cells, it's been manipulated in certain ways, and there's thin coatings on it and stuff like that. We probably have a way to reuse that silicon, but I'm not sure how much of the energy we can recover. In fact, this exact scenario is covered in that recently released report from the National Renewable Energy Lab about how much of that we can recycle. And they try to use different assumptions for, we can recycle this amount or that amount. So the good news is that I think people are thinking a lot about this. And even more exciting part of it is definitely the goal is in 10 years from now that we are literally having to recycle hundreds of gigawatts worth of solar panels every year because they've served a good life. There's another scenario where sometimes these solar panels are maybe they're taken and and put into a different service where the diminished capacity isn't as much of an issue. You know, certain types of off-grid type of things or recreational type of things. So people are definitely thinking about this. Where it is a little bit trickier is that there is one more very commercially important solar technology, which is cadmium telluride. So it's a completely different compound, and it contains two toxic elements, cadmium tellurium. When they're bound together into a cadmium telluride crystal, they're way more stable than either of those. But, you know, I think cadmium is a pretty notorious pollutant. So my understanding is that built into the price of those panels is the cost of essentially insuring and then recycling and recovering all the toxic material from them. So I think people are thinking a lot about this, and we're going to see how a lot of it plays out in the real world very, very soon.
And can I have one follow-up question about that? That was really good. But you mentioned the potential, the heavy metals, some of the toxics of the cadmium and tellurium. Mm-hmm. So that's in disposal, but over the lifetime of the panel, is that material pretty well kept? Yes. If there's no leaching or anything like that of a well-working cell?
Yeah, great question. So yes, so I think first of all, it's all encapsulated very, very, very carefully in different types of polymeric and glass materials. And of course, it's never meant to be underwater or in contact with the ground in any way. What the manufacturers say, which is that it's very, very stable while it's in operation. But you wouldn't really love for, you know, hundreds of gigawatts of those solar panels to be in a landfill. I don't think I would.
All right, great. Well, that's all we have time today. Thank you, Madhu and Larry, so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Madhu Khanna is the director of the Institute for Sustainability, Energy, and the Environment at the U of I, and Larry Lee is a professor of electrical and computer engineering also at the U of I. For those just tuning in, you're listening to Weather Realness, the podcast about weather and climate. I'm Maddie Stover.
And I'm Trent Ford.
Have a weather or climate question you want us to tackle? Leave us a voicemail at 217-333-2141 or email weatherrealness@illinois.edu. Coming up next, we're talking about how solar energy is harvested, whether that's in crop fields or on the roof of your own home.
Illinois Public Media News. This is who we are. Central Illinois is our home and our focus. From Champaign County's most listened to newscasts and conversations that bring the state together, the future will bring changes, but it won't change who we are. Illinois Public Media News on WILL AM and IPMNewsroom.org.